From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Thursday night at 9 p.m. Renowned columnist David Carr was working in the New York Times newsroom when he collapsed. Carr was rushed to Mount Sinai Roosevelt Hospital, but doctors could not revive him. He died at the young age of 58. Carr was a survivor of Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he was relatively thin and fit. The cause of death was ruled as lung cancer complicated by heart disease. Sometimes we have an image of heart disease impacting only the obese or only the elderly. David Carr was neither. We don't know how much he knew about his own heart disease, but this hour we're turning our attention to what we all can do. We're taking a wide-ranging look at heart disease, cardiac rehab, FDA guidelines, the impact of obesity, especially on children, and more. We'll try to answer your questions this hour. If you have any questions or comments on heart disease, you can join the conversation. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also find me at Evan Dawson on Twitter. And my guest for the hour from the Rochester Regional Health System, cardiologist Tim Malins is on the line with us. Tim, how are you?
I'm good. Evan, how about yourself?
Good. Thanks for taking the time. And Karen Pyle's here. She's the manager of the Cardiopulmonary Rehab Center at Unity. Karen, thank you for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm going to start with you, Dr. Malins. First of all, I know you didn't work on David Carr, but let me start there. He had lung cancer, but all the reports I've read indicate that heart disease contributed to his death. How does heart disease complicate someone's health if they are also suffering from something else like lung cancer?
So I think as we know, and we talked about before, and for the most part, everyone kind of understands that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer among Americans. We're doing a pretty good job of it, but with that, it affects a lot of people. And so as you can imagine, if you have something such as lung cancer or another stress on the body, you can certainly unmask coronary disease, which may have been there for some time. It doesn't develop really overnight. Coronary disease is something that some studies have shown that it really can start in adolescence and progressively narrow to a point of where if it's atherosclerosis, to a point of where you get symptoms, or if there's another, you know, illness that's going on, it can certainly contribute to unfortunately, symptoms, and with this gentleman likely contributing to his death.
I think people see a 58-year-old. He looks pretty thin. He's certainly energetic. Looks like he's in good shape. And they think, not that guy. I mean, do we tend to overlook risk in people who don't fit the easy factors that we can see on the outside?
I think as a society, we certainly do. In medicine, it's a little bit more complex because there's a lot of cardiovascular disease inciters or risk factors that don't necessarily show in the image of a thin person. I don't personally know what his family history was, but genetics play a very big role, and not only in the risk of heart disease, but in the risk of having high cholesterol. And so even I've seen very, very thin people, unfortunately, such as myself, who has high cholesterol, but you wouldn't know it looking at me. And it's a genetic predisposition. So although the book can look rosy on the outside, yeah, what's really going on in the vessels may not be reflective of that.
We're going to talk about cholesterol in just a second. Some interesting developments there. Let me ask Karen Pyle, do you occasionally work with people who say, I can't believe heart disease for my dad, my brother, for me? You know, I thought I was doing everything right.
We hear that a lot. A lot of people are very shocked when they are diagnosed with heart disease because they do think they were doing some of the right things or felt that they were more fit. And, or why me? Somebody else could get it, but somebody else can definitely do it. But the why me factor is sometimes in there because people don't always look at, as Dr. Malins was saying, all of their risk and where they actually with their risk themselves.
Let me read an email we got this morning from a listener named Alex, who writes, how much is heart disease related to heredity? I feel like I can exercise all I want. I can eat well, but I fear I know what's coming for me. I lost my father and my father's father and my father's grandfather to various forms of heart disease. Dr. Malins, what would you say to that?
Depending on what risk factors they had and what risk factors he has, I think that he's got a pretty valid point. fortunately, we're in a different era as, and I don't know how old this gentleman is, but we're in a different era, at least going back to his grandfather, possibly his father, because we have far more treatment modalities to improve cardiovascular health. And I'm just going to give you one statistic. And if you want to compare the incidence of cardiovascular death in the early 60s compared to today, we've got over a 50% reduction in cardiovascular disease mortality. And it's because of the things such as back in the early 60s, we didn't have bypass surgery, we didn't have stents, we didn't have the blood pressure medications that we have, we didn't have the cholesterol medications that we have, and I don't think we understood cardiovascular disease as well as we do now. So it's a better time for that gentleman today than it was back in possibly his father's, but certainly his grandfather's time.
Karen, that feels optimistic, but still almost devastatingly difficult to hear for people that they feel like they're doing things well. But I guess part of what I'd like to hear from you is what cardiac rehab really is in 2015 and how it's changed. Because if more of us can survive certain disease or surgeries, et cetera, then at least, you know, there's a chance for us longer term than maybe there used to be.
Well, we definitely focus on exercise and the appropriate exercise for the individual. The other part is, as Dr. Malins was kind of alluding to, was risk factor and lifestyle modification. So are people truly doing what they can do to keep their risk at lowest for them? And sometimes our perception of us keeping it at risk is not truly us keeping it at risk, because we have misinformation of what should our blood pressure be, what should our cholesterol be, how much exercise is enough, am I truly eating healthy, am I truly staying on track.
Where do people go wrong on those areas?
Well, I think that sometimes that people are not as familiar with the guidelines as they think they should be. As my doctor's never told me I have high blood pressure, so it must be fine, where it could have been where some people would have termed borderline for a while, where it truly was high and was just being treated not medically but through diet or exercise or things like that. And basically that's one of those risks that unless you get it measured, you don't even know you have it. So many people can walk around with high blood pressure and never know there's an issue until it becomes an issue. So unless they're getting it checked, unless they're going to their doctor on a regular basis, unless they're getting their blood drawn for their cholesterol, why would they know it until there becomes a problem?
A regular basis starting when?
Well, Dr. Malins, I don't know what the recommendation would be, as I know once they're diagnosed heart-wise, a lot of them are followed every 6 months to a year. Prior to that, I don't even know what the true guidelines are, but everybody, is they have risk factor in the family, should have a baseline information, have that drawn and then being checked at a periodic basis to see is it changing for them so that they can keep a better eye on what's changing and what are they doing.
Okay, well, Dr. Malins, that's a great point. You know, when we think about some other diseases, breast cancer, other forms of disease, if you've got it in your family, that often the medical system wants us in testing earlier. What about heart disease?
So Karen brings up a great point, as do you, Evan. The most important thing is, if you have, say you're young and you have a family history of cardiovascular disease, you don't necessarily have to see a cardiologist. But bringing that up and having discussions about this when you go to see your primary care doctor are very important, because the alarm bells are going to go off saying, well, we're going to really have to check the cholesterol. We're going to have to make sure the blood pressure is at, you know, at appropriate levels, that the patient is doing things such as diet and exercise, and you know, getting in really as a child and a young adult, knowing these things, and going to your doctor and really explaining it, is saying, you know, I have this and it's a concern. And I've said many times is that the most important thing for the doctor-patient relationship is really communication. You should go in, you should know what your blood pressure numbers are and where you should be. You should go in and know what your cholesterol numbers are and what they should be. And these are conversations that not only benefit the patient but also benefit the doctor, because a motivated patient is a great patient, really.
Talking to cardiologist Tim Malins and Karen Pyle, who is the manager of the Cardiopulmonary Rehab Center at Unity. They're here from Rochester Regional Health System as we talk about our heart health today. If you've got questions or comments, we're hearing from some of you online at Twitter, at Evan Dawson, or on the phone, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Jack writes to the program, "My dad died of heart disease. After that happened, I lost 50 pounds and I try to work out regularly, but I see conflicting information about whether I can be overdoing it. I've been training for a marathon. Is that too much?" I hear this question all the time. I'll start with Dr. Malins. Marathon running, as a cardiologist, does it bother you?
You know, there is some data, and I'm not sure if a marathon would qualify, but these real endurance athletes.
Like super marathons? Like
the super marathons and these Ironman triathlons and things like that. There is increased risk of cardiovascular death when you put your bodies to extremes. I've had marathon runners, and I've had people who do these things. And what I say is, you don't have to run a marathon to get into cardiovascular health. That's not what you need to do. You need to exercise moderately for at least 30 minutes a day, five days a week. Now, on the other hand, I'm not going to tell somebody if they are going to train properly and they're going to have adequate knowledge about how to maintain electrolytes, how to maintain enough energy, and have trained hard enough for it, they can do it safely. But you don't have to run a marathon, and that's, I think, what people feel is, I've got to do this ultimate, you know, exercise. It doesn't take a lot to get the cardiovascular benefits from it, but if done safely, you can run a marathon. I would argue against the Ironman triathlons and those type of things.
Sure. And Karen, what about people who are rehabbing? That's kind of a different scenario entirely, but you know, for people who want to get in better shape, they do not need to target 26.2, I don't think, right?
No, they do not. Just along the same lines of what Dr. Malins was saying, the gold standard guidelines through the American College of Sports Medicine really is to aim for 150 minutes a week, which is 30 minutes 5 days a week. So that is the same goal whether somebody is with us who's recently had a heart event or the general population. So everybody really needs to be working on that activity fitness level.
Do people ask about, I want to try to do a half marathon, I want to, like, for example, you know, Jack writing in, his dad died of heart disease. I don't think, he didn't mention if he had any diagnosis, but it inspired him to lose a bunch of weight, to try to do all this. I understand that sentiment, but we can take it too far, Karen?
I think we can take it too far at times, but I do have individuals who that is their goal. They want to do a 5K, they want to do a half marathon, things like that. The difference, too, is that they are looking at it realistically of what sort of pace are they going to be doing it at, that they're planning to do a jog walk or something like that instead of that they're planning to win the event. So there's a different level of running or training and things along those lines. But having goals is not necessarily a bad thing, but I agree with Dr. Malins that sometimes we need to set more realistic goals of where are we heading and what do we actually want to get out of it.
Let me grab our first phone call of the hour, and this is Margaret in Rochester. Margaret, thanks for calling. Go ahead. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. I just left a comment. I didn't know I would be talking to someone.
Oh, sure. Well, you're on. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that when I was 68, going on 69, you know, I was a reasonably active woman. I went regularly to my doctor. I didn't have high blood pressure. I didn't have high cholesterol. But my younger brother was told he had to have a stent put in. He had some problems. I went back to my doctor, and she arranged for me to have, I can't think of the words now, but anyway, you know, I had all the things done I needed to have done. Nothing showed up, and then a few months later, I had a heart attack and a stent put in. And since that time, you know, I'm now 78, I have had no problems. And in fact, the last time I saw my cardiologist, he says, oh, come back in 2 years. So I just, you know, it was just this sudden event.
Okay, but how are you feeling now?
Oh, I'm feeling okay. I'm feeling okay.
Were you feeling? Were you surprised? It sounds like you were surprised that after that initial examination that you ended up with a heart attack.
I was very surprised because I thought I'd done everything I should do. I thought, you know, it would have shown up on the test and everything, but it didn't. Nothing showed up.
Margaret, stay on the line. Dr. Malins, I guess that's life. I mean, we can't nail every one of them. But,
no, right. No, I just wanted to say that all of those things that you tell us to do will work.
So, Margaret, thank you very much for your phone call.
Yeah.
The story is, unfortunately, what we do see. There's a subgroup, and it's not a small subgroup of people. We classify heart attacks into two areas. One where the blockage slowly builds up over time, and people are getting anginal-type symptoms, so chest pain, pressure, jaw pain, shortness of breath, back pain, all of those. Now, women tend to have more atypical symptoms, and that's why I think it's very important for women when they have questionable cardiac angina or symptoms could relate to the heart to be seen immediately. But what sounds like what happened with Margaret, and kind of extrapolating what she had said, she wasn't without risk factors. So age, women, I assume if she was 68, 69, postmenopausal, yes. I use as a risk factor, and family history, genetics.
Right. Yes.
And so likely what happened was they did a stress test,
yes.
And those only pick up the severe blockages. But what happens in a subgroup of people is it's not a severe blockage that causes the heart attack. It's a mild to moderate blockage which opens up and subsequently causes a clot and then the subsequent heart attack. And those cannot be detected on a stress test. They're asymptomatic before. And those are best treated with primary prevention, so with making sure the cholesterol is good, with exercise, watching the blood pressure. Unfortunately, Margaret had the event, but again, let's think back to what I said earlier. If this was 1962, she just had to have the heart attack, no stent, and she either lives or she doesn't live. And if she does live, she's probably bedridden for 2 to 3 months.
Oh, thank goodness that didn't happen.
Well, Margaret, thanks for the call. And, you know, unfortunately, as Dr. Malins points out here, you said that subgroup is not as small as we'd like to think or would want to believe, right?
That's right. That's right.
A lot of interesting questions coming in about food and eating, even one about race. We're going to get to a lot of different points here, but I want to direct the conversation to a recent piece that my colleague Beth Adams did when it comes to some changing guidelines. And let me read the story that Beth wrote just a couple of weeks ago about what's coming forward here, and then we'll talk to our panel about this. Beth writes, quote, "When the federal government updates its guidelines this year on what constitutes a healthy diet, there could be a big change, and advisory committees recommending that cholesterol should no longer be avoided. Doctors tell us there's no evidence that eating a lot of cholesterol is bad. There's plenty of evidence that high levels of cholesterol in your body is bad. Your body makes cholesterol. In fact, it makes a lot more cholesterol than when you eat cholesterol. The body turns saturated fat into cholesterol, so foods high in that type of fat should still be restricted. The federal government's new guidelines are expected to come out within the next few weeks, and experts review dietary recommendations every 5 years. Dr. Malins, this seems to me, I mean, I don't follow these guidelines very often, but this seems like a big change. First of all, do you agree with what I just read with some of your colleagues in the industry, that there's no evidence that eating a lot of cholesterol is necessarily bad?
Well, I mean, I think a diet. Well, let me step back. So, what Beth had said is absolutely true. Our bodies, our serum cholesterol, which what we check, we know there's a very high correlation to elevated levels of cholesterol and risk for cardiovascular disease. So there's no question about that. The FDA is not questioning that, and nobody's really questioning that. I think what they're saying is how much does dietary cholesterol contribute? The truth is that the vast majority of our cholesterol that we have circulating in our body is made by our liver. It's what makes it. We need cholesterol. We use it to make things. There is roughly between maybe 15, 20, 25% comes from our diet. Now, that's not negligible. That is important. And so I still think that you should, not just say, oh, I can eat all the cholesterol I want. Let's get all the butter, because we know that that's not good. I'll be interested to see what they come out with and what they say, but it doesn't change from my standpoint saying that for cardiovascular health, I want you to reduce your overall cholesterol that you're intaking, and then you're going to make what you make, but you've got to use more of it. And to get the cholesterol, to get your serum cholesterol down. And by using more of it, you're going to use more of it the more you exercise, the more you get your heart up, the more muscle you build. And the healthier you are, the more you're going to use. If you sit on a couch and watch TV, all the cholesterol isn't being used for what it's needed to be. So although they may, say the overall daily cholesterol value is a little higher, I don't think that it should be, forgotten and saying, well, you can just do whatever you want because it's all your body, because that's just not physiology. And we really need to pay attention to that, especially those with risk factors and known coronary disease.
Now, the federal government tends to, and the FDA tends to take attack of whatever they end up recommending. They always say moderation. Moderation, which is, I certainly understand, and I suspect that no matter what comes from them, they will continue to urge moderation. But what about some specific foods? You mentioned butter. What about a few eggs a day?
Well, it depends. It really depends. So if your cholesterol, if you're one of the people who are have very good genes and really have very low cholesterol, no matter what you eat, then eggs aren't going to hurt you. But for somebody like me or somebody like one of Karen's patients who have had coronary events and things like that, one egg may be the amount of cholesterol that you need in a day. And we're talking about reductions in LDL, that's the bad cholesterol, to prevent a second heart attack in these people. And so everything that you can do to get it down, and I've always said that diet and exercise is better than medications. If you can do it with diet and exercise, this is not necessarily for the people who've had coronary events, but for primary prevention, trying to prevent the first one, that's the way to do it. If you can do it on your own, you don't need medications.
Karen, when it comes to your patients, how often is cholesterol part of the conversation?
Cholesterol is definitely part of the conversation. When they first initially start the program, we're looking at their cholesterol levels and where they within the guidelines to see do they need to be focused on things along those lines. And then just what Dr. Malins was saying, we're focusing in on what can we do to affect our cholesterol levels. So we do look a lot at the diet and the exercise and what are they doing and what sort of choices are they making, mm-hmm. and are they actually making the better choices. So most individuals can definitely lower their cholesterol intake, eat higher fiber, have more fruits and vegetables and more healthy whole grains and things along those lines, which definitely help in the long run.
Let me get to the phones because John in Parenton has a question about cholesterol. Go ahead, John.
Yes. Let me take you off speaker just a second.
Oh, sure. Okay. We appreciate that, John. Thanks.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes. I'm one of those folks that had that was pretty active, and actually at the end of a 5K had a mild heart attack. I had a stress test 8 days before that. So my family history was my father did die of a heart attack. So I was of course surprised because I thought I was fairly decently watching my weight and exercising and et cetera. So since then I've been very fortunate. I've had a stent. I'm back pretty active. But the question has been how much to reduce statins, and I've through some diet and et cetera, I've gotten my numbers way down in the amount of statin I take. But I have an interesting situation in which I've heard that there is information we know, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the brain uses cholesterol and needs cholesterol. And there, I understand some information, literature, that widespread use of statins can perhaps lead to more early dementia. And so I wonder what the doctor's opinion is.
Well, stay there, John. Let me start with Dr. Malins. We've had a lot of questions already this hour. Confusion over who should be taking statins and if they can have those deleterious results. First of all, any evidence that they can lead to dementia?
Yes. So there's two things that have come up. I mean, so every medication will have a side effect. So let me step back. So with statin medications, you can have liver problems, you can have muscle problems, there's some data that indicates there maybe a very slight increase in the incidence of dementia and a very slight increase in the fasting glucose in people. So those are the four big ones that, that we think about with it. Now, in John's situation, so this is a secondary prevention. So he's already had his first heart attack, and so we're with our guidelines, we're more aggressive with this. And so what we want to prevent in John is that second heart attack. And so we'll be very aggressive to try to get at least a 50% reduction in his bad cholesterol, the LDL, with medications. Now, there are some other effects of statin medications outside of just the LDL-lowering component of it, which make people live longer after heart attacks. And so for him, it's not a primary prevention. So he would be recommended that you would use statin medications. And, with that said, there are some side effects, but at least on the surface and what he explains, if he's not able to get his cholesterol very, very low on his own, with a history of coronary disease, with a family history of coronary disease and with high cholesterol, the benefits of a statin just, I mean, I don't know his case here, but he, just on the surface, the benefits of a statin on him would outweigh any of the side effects.
Okay. Well, thank you. If I can just sort of append to that a bit, one of the things that did bother me a lot with the statins were muscle aches. It was really bad, and so I was able to get my through diet. Over a couple of years now, I've been able to get my LDL down to about 160, and actually raise the HCL after going off to above what I was able to achieve when I was on the statin. And it took about 4 months for the muscle aches to go away. But that's been very nice that the muscle aches have gone away. However, you're correct. So the cholesterol numbers have come up. And it sounds like you feel that the dementia situation is slight. Is that or?
That's correct.
That's not a big consideration. Is that correct?
I mean, it's a consideration for anyone, but I think in your situation, now, it sounds like you're no longer on the statin medication.
A trial of getting off for 6 months. That's correct.
And your LDL was 160, which is still very high. And that, you know, unfortunately, if you can't take the medication, you can't take the medication. But that's a high number, and that's concerning, especially given the fact that you had a previous coronary event.
Okay.
John, thanks for the call. I hope we addressed some of your questions. We are late for a break, and we're coming back to the phones. Brian in Rochester, Joe in Irondequoit, you're next. We're talking to cardiologist Tim Malins from Rochester Regional Health System, Karen Pyle, the manager of the Cardiopulmonary Rehab Center at Unity, and your question straight ahead after the 60 seconds on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, Landshark. Our favorite SNL sketches were relived last night with a 3.5-hour marathon celebrating 40 years since the launch of Saturday Night Live. But is SNL still needed? The satire that was so fresh in 1975, maybe not as fresh today. We're going to talk to young comics about trying to make it in 2015 and the legacy of SNL next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Community Design Center presenting Reshaping Rochester, Conversations on Our Region's Future. Urban designer and architect Lee Quill speaks February 25th on Regreening the Living City. Details at cdcrochester.org.
Welcome back to Connections, and on this blustery winter day, maybe more snow in the forecast. Joe in Irondequoit has a question that I think a lot of us have. Go ahead, Joe.
It's Joel, incidentally.
Yes, go ahead, Joe.
I just came in from working with a non-self-propelled snow thrower. I'm 71 years old. I have cardiomyopathy and a pacemaker. Am I taking too big a chance? I don't work to exhaustion, and I am moderately active. I do have a part-time job. Am I taking too big a chance?
Dr.
Malins? Give me some feedback?
Yeah, Dr. Malins?
So tell me, so you have a pacemaker or defibrillator? I didn't catch that.
I have both.
Okay.
It's a pacemaker defibrillator.
Okay. And so you have You have...
I have cardiomyopathy, if that's of any help.
Was it from coronary disease?
I really don't know. All I know is one day, about 3.5 years ago, I was very short of breath, and I went through our registered cardiopulmonary, and they recommended medication and the defibrillator pacemaker, and I haven't had any problems with it for 3.5 years. But I'm just wondering if I'm pushing it too, is it too dangerous for me to be out in the snow with this situation?
Did you ever have an angiogram, or did you have stents or bypass surgery?
I had an angiogram. My arteries were pretty good.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, and it's me, you know, I think Karen can also weigh in on this. And so it depends what your workload is, how you're feeling, and really what your cardiologist says. I mean, he knows more about what, because there's a lot of variables, you know, how weak your heart is functioning. Or how strong it is.
Well, my nephrologist keeps telling me my heart is weak, so I'm just wondering about that. And the cardiologist never said anything about that, but my nephrologist does. I only have one kidney, incidentally.
Okay. You know, I think if it's moderate exercise and you're feeling well, and you haven't had any arrhythmias from the device, the device isn't shocking your heart back into rhythm.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, then moderate exercise should be okay, but maybe Karen could weigh in on that as well.
Well, I definitely think that whether people think about it or not, adding the factor of the cold weather definitely makes activities outside harder than we actually think that they are, just because of the weather extreme. So people need to take that into consideration, too, when they're doing things outside in the cold. And because literally sometimes it makes it almost twice as hard on our bodies just because of that decreased temperature. So I think that's important to keep in mind, and being fit enough to do the activity. So whether we think about it or not, I know you were saying snowblower, but I mean snow shoveling, things like that are pretty high activities where some people actually aren't physically fit enough to do those activities.
No, I don't hand shovel.
Yeah.
I just push the machine and hope it does the work.
Yeah, and some, which is the better way to do it. So
yeah,
for sure.
I don't run work till I'm out of breath. So I guess working at that pace, is that dangerous?
I agree with Dr. Malins that I don't know.
Moderate,
yeah.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Joel. And we had a question earlier online on Twitter, at Evan Dawson on Twitter, just about whether someone was asking whether they should be running out to shovel for their elderly neighbors. Did they get nervous for their elderly neighbors in this kind of weather? I understand why. I think it's a good question. Dr. Malins, should we be all going outside to shovel for our neighbors if they're a little older?
Well, again, I think that what we do and the intensity is something that we need to think about. And if you're out there and you haven't snowed in, if you haven't shoveled snow in 2-3 weeks, then certainly you may want to do it very, you know, slowly, 5 minutes at a time. It also depends on what kind of shape you're in. If you're somebody who's going to the gym 5 days a week and you're feeling great, then you can go out there and do it for, you know, 20 minutes. But if you get symptoms, you need to certainly get them checked out.
Let me get back to the phones. Brian in Rochester. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had my first heart attack at 42. I'm 52 now. My brothers and my entire side of my father's family, I happen to be the youngest in my family, but they're entirely gone now, from heart disease and heart-associated risks. I was lucky enough to have, I was working at Strong Hospital when I had my heart attack, so someone was looking over me that day. And Karen, I think, may have even helped me rehab when she was working somewhere else, if I remember correctly. But I have, my body does not tolerate statins, and I'm on, I don't know if the doc has heard about Niaspan. It's basically an extended release niacin, and I was just wondering if you could give me some comments about that, and I'd appreciate that.
Can I ask you one thing? What didn't you tolerate with the statins?
It was bothering my liver.
Okay. So, you know, statins have side effects, and even to go back to the memory issue, you know, it was once, I want to at least, you know, say something additional about that. It was one or two studies, and further studies have shown that there's likely not a contributing factor to memory. And I think that's kind of an unanswered question. But if there is, it's something very minimal. Now, the liver issues and the muscle issues are something that we see quite commonly. And it's very hard because it's really the best class of medication that we have. But we do see those side effects, you know, fairly commonly. Now, what he's speaking about is niaspan, and that is a niacin compound. And that, unfortunately, I mean, I use it in rare circumstances, but the data on that really hasn't done a great job of supporting that it truly will reduce cardiovascular events. Now, if you're intolerant of all the other medications, we're certainly going to try anything we can, and then you'd look at the numbers and see if that works. But as far as, you know, using that as a primary medication to treat cholesterol, we really are moving away from that. If you're intolerant of all the other ones, I think certainly trying anything that's going to get a result in the individual patient is a reasonable goal.
That answer your question, Brian?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to call. Here's Jake writing to the program about cholesterol. He says, with those new guidelines soon to come out about cholesterol, which basically seem to reverse previous common thinking, at least as far as the general public goes. And by the way, I would just jump in to say, as Dr. Malin's indicated, we're going to wait to see what they are, but that doesn't change the fact that some of us may be more at risk or susceptible and have to be concerned about cholesterol. But I take the point from Jake, and let me finish his comment here. Jake writes, various studies such as coffee constantly being released, it feels like every 6 months things flip-flop between good versus bad. I wonder if your panel could comment on how much mixed information is out there, and how does the average Joe keep up with truly good information? Good question. Dr. Malins?
Great question. Because we're inundated with it as well. Everything changes. We recently had a change in our blood pressure guidelines. We recently had a change in our cholesterol guidelines. There's new evidence coming out every day in the internet world, and with all of the information at our fingertips, it's very different from when I was, you know, in college, when there was really, you know, if you wanted information, you got it in the book or you got it out of the paper. Now, there's information coming out and teasing out what is real scientific data versus what is guidelines is difficult, and it's hard for me to keep up with. So I certainly understand his question, and my feeling is that yes, things change, and as with anything, is as we learn more about the human body, as we learn more about the effects of disease, especially when it comes to cardiovascular health, things are going to change. I would say that, you know, the best would be to either talk with, I don't know if he has a cardiologist or if he has a primary, we'd talk to them, or go, if you're on the internet, go to reputable websites. You can look at, you know, Cleveland Clinic has a great website, the American Heart Association has a great website, the American College of Cardiology, which is our governing body, has a good website. But you can almost search for anything on the internet, and you can have some information. Now, doesn't mean the information is correct, but yes. So I totally understand the confusion with everything's changing, but the goal is we want to make sure that your serum cholesterol is down. We want to keep people healthy. We want to keep people heart attack free. And if they've had a heart attack, we want to try to avoid the second one.
All right, Karen, well, then Jake hit a very specific one. Can we drink coffee?
It depends on who you ask. that keeps going in controversy up and down. At one time, they were always thinking that the caffeine would affect like heart rates, things along those lines, and that's why they were asking people to avoid it. Now they're questioning how much of that it actually affects. So most physicians that I've worked with in the past are back to that term of moderation. So they were saying one or two cups a day.
Dr. Malin's coffee drinker?
I am not much of a coffee drinker, but I don't. For the vast majority of people, 1 to 2 cups of coffee a day isn't going to give you a problem.
All right. Well, that's at least comforting for those of us who have built that into our routines. 844-295-TALK if you want to join the program with a question or a comment as we talk about heart health. 844-295-8255. or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Cardiologist Tim Malin's on the line with us. Karen Pyle is the manager of the Cardiopulmonary Rehab Center at Unity, and we appreciate their time and expertise. Elias is a listener who wrote this morning and just wanted to make sure that we talk about what appears to be a link between the African-American community and higher rates of heart disease. I don't know if that's right, but that had me Googling before our program, and I found the story of a doctor in San Francisco, and I just want to read this brief excerpt from the article from San Francisco Chronicle. Quote, most of her young patients at the Bayview Child Health Center were from the surrounding predominantly African-American neighborhood in southeastern San Francisco. Their home lives were largely plagued by poverty, domestic abuse, and chaos. And later in life, many of them developed chronic illnesses. But were the two related? About 7 years ago, Burke Harris read a study that finally connected the dots. Childhood exposure to trauma was strongly and scientifically linked to all kinds of ailments and risky behaviors. Heart disease, hepatitis, autoimmune disease, cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, depression, and suicide. Dr. Malin's going back to Elias's comment saying let's not leave out that part of the conversation for minority communities. Is that correct?
There's no question there are some differences between communities or between African Americans, Caucasian, Pacific Islanders, as well as Hispanics, that there is a somewhat of a difference between rates of cardiovascular disease. And so the question is exactly why? Is it socioeconomic? Is it genetic? And I think it's likely a combination of everything. You could argue that, you know, if somebody, and I've said this for any community, and I think this is true of whatever race or gender you're coming from, but if you're from a lower socioeconomic status, the diet, it's hard to get healthy foods. Very hard to get, you know, it's easy to go and get a Big Mac for a dollar versus fresh fish at the store, which is going to cost you $10. And so that's difficult. There's also higher rates of smoking related to education levels. Also, what is the access to health care? What is the access to really good health care? And so I'm not certain that it's solely a DNA type of risk factor. My suspicion is that it's a combination of environment as well as genes.
Let me get back to the phones, and before I take Mindy's call in Rochester, I see what she wants to talk about, and every good host has to be honest when they've made a mistake. I should not have gone this far into the hour without mentioning a specific word that I think is a very, very important part of the conversation. Mindy, that word is inflammation. I know you wanted to go there. Go ahead.
Yeah. Why didn't you mention inflammation? Because I think that's a real contributing factor towards heart disease. And furthermore, I think a person's genetic DNA in relation to inflammation, if you happen to have a less diverse microbiome in your guts, you don't have as many good gut bacteria, and in your genetic sequencing, you've had family histories of heart disease, stroke, I think that the person's own liver may tend to produce more cholesterol to encompass and surround the bad bacteria that can cause inflammation to your organs, all your organs. So I think there's a multiple causation factor for heart disease, and I think your genetic sequencing is a very important point, and inflammation. And I think that where the cholesterol comes in, a person's liver may be more prone to producing cholesterol, hypercholesterolemia, because their genetic sequencing, they have less diverse microbiome, In other words, the end result is inflammation and a strong contributing factor to heart disease and heart attack.
Mindy, thanks for the call. Let me let Dr. Malin start, and then we'll jump over to Karen Pyle as well. Go ahead, Dr. Malin.
Okay, so the inflammation issue, I'll just kind of tackle that. It was a bit of a complex question there, but I'll stick with that. So inflammation certainly, without question, contributes to coronary disease. And I'm not talking necessarily about full-body inflammation, but specifically with these plaques. And the plaques that these atherosclerotic plaques that that cause heart attacks and cause angina, those are very, very active inflammation factories. And the more inflammation, the bigger the plaques are going to get. And how we really can stabilize those is treating blood pressure, is treating cholesterol, treating diabetes, not smoking. And those will help bring down the inflammation specifically in that plaque. But inflammation certainly plays a role in plaque formation.
Karen?
No, I agree with Dr. Malins. All those things definitely play a big role of risk factor modification to try to keep our risk lower. I think one risk that we haven't mentioned is actually stress, whether we think about it or not, that there's a lot of stress in our society with the electronic, with the versions, with constantly connected, no downtime, all different sorts of things. So I think that's important to bring in to everything as well.
And before I grab one more phone call, the Journal of Pediatrics talks about potential issues with, well, Mindy mentioned inflammation, but just essentially the way we eat that can cause that. And we're seeing obesity in kids remains a challenge for us. And so here's medical news today with the headline, low-fat, plant-based vegan diet may reduce heart disease risk in obese children. And they write, quote, among the complications of obesity include an increased risk of heart disease. But for children and adolescents who are obese, the risk could be reduced with a low-fat, plant-based vegan diet, according to a new study published in the Journal of Pediatrics. Dr. Malins, what do you think?
If you can do it, it's probably, there's truth to it. I mean, you're going to really reduce, I mean, if you're eating the right plants and the good fatty acids that are in the majority of these plants, then you're doing okay. The problem is that it's really not a realistic solution to kids. I mean, it's very hard to. I tried doing just as an experiment. I tried doing a vegan diet for 6 weeks, and it was extremely hard for me. And I have a lot of resources. I think although I think it's a good recommendation, but realistically, are we going to be able to do that? And I think the way we are and the cost of doing that and the having to avoid a lot of things, although I suspect it would decrease cholesterol and decrease obesity, putting the metal or the rubber to the road on that across the country would be very, very difficult.
How bad is the situation with kids, obesity, and potential cardiovascular disease?
It's bad. It's really bad. We did see, I think it was last year or the year before, we saw some stabilizing or even maybe some decrease in the childhood obesity rates, but we're still very high. We have high incidence of childhood diabetes, of childhood hypertension, and again, I think a lot of it comes down to our ability or our availability to very high carbohydrate-dense, fat-dense foods at a cheap price is part of the problem. We need to somehow figure out a way to get back to more healthy foods, less calorie dense, less fat dense, and I think we would see the availability. The problem is right now they're more expensive. Like I said, it's cheaper to go get a burger for $1 with 500, 600 calories and more fat than you probably need in a day and a huge amount of carbohydrates than it is to go get fruits and vegetables and a piece of salmon.
One more phone call is Beth in Rochester. Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about triglycerides and also heard about COQ10. I don't know much about that. And exercise would be the last thing I haven't heard too much about.
But what's the question on triglycerides?
Well, I hear they play a part in heart disease, how to lower them, and part of them, I think, is hereditary. But part of them is diet and exercise.
Okay. Dr. Malins?
True, she's right. So their diet and genetics, as well as alcohol consumption. So triglycerides are essentially the circulating fats in our bodies. Excuse me. We do calculate them in our total cholesterol. It's part of the calculation in there, and I use them depending on the number is to say, okay, you know, something else is going on. We're seeing a lot of circulating fats in our body. It may be genetic. It may be diet, and alcohol is another contributing factor to seeing high triglycerides. They're a piece of the puzzle. I don't believe them to be nearly as important as looking at LDL, but they're also not something that we ignore.
30 seconds. I was somebody with WPW, Wolff Parkinson White syndrome. I had a catheter ablation when I was 17. I wonder how things have changed in terms of that. Do I need to be going back and getting tested for delta waves and the like 20 years later?
Wow, big one for 30 seconds. WPW, I'll be very quick, is a little extra piece of tissue.
Oh, no. Right when he was going to offer the explanation, we lost Dr. Malins. I don't know if he'll buzz back in here. How about this, Dr. Malins? If we can get Dr. Malins back on the program at some point, which we will soon, maybe we'll do a show on WPW. He was going to answer my question, and then all of a sudden technology ruined it. But, Karen, do you deal with patients who've had WPW and ablations?
We do, but I can't answer your question.
And then the frequency, that's all right. But Dr. Malins will as well. Hopefully the patients that you work with are doing pretty well, though. I mean, I'm amazed what ablations can do.
Oh, no. Patients that we're working with are doing excellent, and they can definitely make a big change by those risk factor modifications and working on exercise and taking care of themselves. That they're amazed, and unfortunately many of them say that they feel so much better than they have in years, but they had to have that event to kickstart them to head in the right direction.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for the work you do. Karen Pyle, the manager of the Cardiopulmonary Rehab Center at Unity, thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Malins, we're going to catch up with you again on a separate program. I'm so sorry about the disconnect right at the end there, but great work. He's a cardiologist with Rochester Regional Health System. Short break, and we're looking at SNL at 40 next hour. Stay with us.